Shrink Wrap Radio number 416, Trauma and the Soul, with Dr. Donald Kalshid.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is noted clinical psychologist and Jungian analyst, Dr. Donald Kalshid, and we'll be discussing his latest book, Trauma and the Soul, A Psycho-Spiritual Approach to Human Development and Its Interruption. You can find out more about Dr. Donald Kalshid by visiting our show notes for this episode on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Donald Kalshid, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you on the show. Several of my listeners suggested that I should interview you, and I'm glad to finally have the opportunity, especially given that you're on vacation way up in Newfoundland.
That's right, Newfoundland, Canada, looking out at the Atlantic Ocean here at whales and seagulls and eagles.
Wow, it just really seems like it would be idyllic up there. It's wonderful that you can create that respite in your life.
Yes, it is.
Well, I believe it's been about 13 years since you wrote a book that was somewhat similarly titled, A Book on Trauma and the Soul. What led you to write this newest one?
Well, the original book that you just referenced was called The Inner World of Trauma. I was inspired to write it because a lot of my clients were having dreams that interested me greatly, particularly at certain points in their lives when if they had a history of early childhood abuse or trauma or relational trauma, what we call relational trauma, which isn't always major abusive events but can be things like neglect and emotional illiteracy in a family. Anyway, a lot of these patients, when they tried to change and tried to emerge from their more restricted life and more defended life, started to have nightmares in which a young and vulnerable part of themselves was being attacked by various figures. And I got very interested in the fact that this was occurring. And as a Jungian analyst, I got interested in the parallels between these dreams and certain mythic themes in the history of Western mythology.
Yeah, we'll get into that more as we go on. I thought that was you drew some remarkable parallels there, and I want to underscore what you just said, because the title does say Trauma and the Soul, and the trauma that you're talking about is a very particular kind of trauma, and it's the developmental trauma of poor child care, to put it bluntly, in the early years. Now, by your own admission, you were more timid in the first book to use such terms as soul and spiritual, and you seem to be much more adventurous in this regard in this latest book.
Yes, the later book is much more adventurous in that respect, because after the first book, which made quite an impact, at least in the small Jungian readership and, you know, psychoanalytic readership, I continued to be interested in this field and to explore this complex, what I call the self-care system, of defense, which is this this mythopoetic complex of a protector and a persecutor and a child locked up in an inner world someplace. And as I became involved with those patients and continued to follow their material, I began to become aware that many of them had remarkable mystical experiences, synchronicity experiences, paranormal experiences, experiences that we would call sort of visionary and spiritual experiences as children and as young people. And sometimes those experiences were life-saving for them. So I realized that, you know, that when the coherence of their psyche was broken, and they were falling into a world that was, that Jung would have called the archetypal world or the collective unconscious, and that in that world there were forces and powers that that were either benevolent or malevolent, and it was some of those experiences that I tried to record in this recent book.
Yeah. And so had you in some way become more open to the paranormal, to the spiritual, etc., in the intervening years, or was it just that you were hearing these themes and feeling like they needed to be represented?
It was more that I don't know, maybe I have become more open to these things in my elder age. I'm 71 now, so, you know, I think as we age and get into our 60s and 70s, we're more open to the ineffable. I've always been a kind of a mystically inclined person. I've had various powerful experiences of mystical experiences mm-hmm. in nature and reading poetry and hearing music, and I've been pretty close to the mystical literature in general. But what interested me is that these patients of mine were natural mystics. They seemed to have a capacity and a propensity and an openness to the ineffable that I resonated with because of my own personal history, but also I began to get very interested in the fact that that this world, which we call the spiritual world or the ineffable world, seemed to have a role in protecting them protecting a certain innocent core of the personality when the kinds of protections that these kids needed in their families just weren't there. So they sort of retreated into this magical spiritual world and there found protectors. Unfortunately, they also found persecutors.
Right. It's kind of interesting and paradoxical, although you do spell out the dynamics of that. Now, you describe your approach as a binocular one. What are you getting at there? And that's kind of a theme that runs through the book, is sort of looking at using one eye and this other eye.
You know, I got inspired with the idea of a binocular way of looking at trauma because of a whalebone carving, a mask that was given to me, actually given to my wife Robin by a friend of hers, carved by an unknown Inuit Eskimo carver in the northwest coast of Alaska, and it's this very arresting face with one eye open and one eye closed, and it's called the Storyteller. And I got very intrigued with that because the clear implication of that is that the best stories that we have, the storyteller, is always looking two ways at once. One outwardly into the, you know, time and space world that we all live our extroverted lives in, but also inwardly into the inner world and the mysteries of interiority. So I felt that it was an important way of framing the book, the one inner world being more connected to spiritual realities or ineffable realities that are experienced as spiritual by us, and the outer world more the ordinary time and space bound material world that we associate with scientific explorations. You know, Jung was somebody who always looked with two eyes his whole life. He even gave these two perspectives the name of his number one and his number two personality. His number one personality was the part that was well adapted to the world and went to medical school and became a psychiatrist and a world famous writer And the other part of him was his number two personality, which he felt lived in what he called God's world, which was the inner world of dreams and visions and premonitions and intuitions and experiences of what he called the numinous.
And another word that you seem to use throughout the book that I think refers to that same world is mythopoetic. Do I have that right?
Yes, the mythopoetic. That was a word coined by Frederick Myers as pertaining to a function of the unconscious. He felt that it was that the human imagination, which was naturally which is a basic endowment of all people, and certainly very strong in certain individuals, creative individuals, was the tendency of the psyche to express itself in mythic and poetic form. And of course, that was very close to Jung's heart, because he was a very mythopoetic guy. He remembered his dreams from very early childhood and recorded them in all his life. And in his famous Red Book, which was published within the last 10 years, you know, there's all kinds of imagery as well as dreams. So he was, the mythopoetic function of the psyche is that function of the psyche that we have access to through our dreams, our visions, our imagination, our stories. And it's terribly important, because the soul seems to live happily in the mythopoetic.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem to live very happily in the dried up world of purely rational, linear, what is now known as left hemisphere thinking.
Yeah. Now, as we said earlier, the sort of trauma that you're focusing on here involves a rupture in the earliest stages of development. For whatever reason, a solid attachment to the mother doesn't happen, and so there's a reflexive, defensive process in the infant psyche, the purpose of which is meant to be protective. However, you note that there's both an upside and a downside, if you will, to this defensive strategy. So if I understand you correctly, this traumatic wound has the upside, potentially, of also creating a sort of spiritual sensitivity, which put me in mind of Jung's wounded healer and also the Grail hero.
Yes, that's exactly right. The upside is that the survivor of unhappiness, wounding, rupture, interruption in the interpersonal world frequently finds him or herself repairing to the mythopoetic world. You know, these are kids who often have special gifts in the inner world, and they have imaginary playmates. They're very highly sensitized to things that go on around them. They have a sixth sense. They're connected to animals in an especially powerful way. They often have imaginary playmates that can be animals. And so they opened up to the inner world in ways that better adapted people aren't always necessarily. I mean, these are generalizations. There's a big downside to this way of being opened up to the inner world also, because, you know, these kids tend to retreat into the inner world and to be held there in safety and sanctuary with an innocent part of them in safekeeping, but they're also often very unadapted and not well related to the outer world, therefore, and consequently, you know, frequently in later years they become very depressed and they require psychotherapy.
Yeah. So if I understand correctly, the wholeness of the psyche is ruptured or fractured and split, and one consequence of this is that the soul fails to indwell the body. That's a phrase that you kind of dwelled on quite a bit, about the soul indwelling in the body and thereby leading to an inauthentic way of being in the world.
Right. This whole issue of the indwelling soul is something that I took from two people, two sources. One is John Keats in a letter to his brother very early in his life, which is frequently quoted by James Hillman and archetypal psychologists. I can't quote the whole thing for you because I don't remember it, but the idea, he started off, he says, oh, I have it here. He says, call the world, if you will, the veil of soul making. Then you will find out the use of the word, of the world. And he continues, I say soul making, soul as distinguished from an intelligence. There are many intelligences, but they're not souls until they've undergone a certain amount of suffering. And he talks about the sparks, which are those intelligences and vital centers of energy that each of us brings into the world, developing as the individual develops into a soul through the process of losing our omnipotence, but also suffering into unique and particularity that is part of what each of us brings. And I combined that with Donald Winnicott's wonderful ideas about indwelling. He has this very interesting phrase where he says, the mother is continually introducing and reintroducing the baby's mind and body to each other. And by that he means that the mother, you know, identifies what the baby is feeling in her empathy and gives it a name. And if it's a bad feeling, she soothes it. And if it's a good feeling, she amplifies it. And the baby slowly goes back and forth between body and mind. And in that process, Winnicott says something miraculous happens that he calls indwelling. And he calls it the indwelling of the psyche and the soma. But the psyche is another word for soul. And so I use this throughout the book that if that process has broken down, then the soul has a problematic descent into the body, and it tends to remain disembodied and to take refuge in the unconscious, so that we get dreams of an orphaned or forsaken child or a wounded animal in some woods or fortress somewhere, protected by other forces. And that part of the psyche is very sacred and very special, and it if it doesn't get a chance to come down into the body, the person can suffer from feelings of not really feeling alive or fully vital or even feeling real.
Actually, you have some wonderful dreams that you've quoted in the book, along with myths and fairy tales. And as we go on, I've highlighted a couple of the dreams that I might ask you go into. The task of the psychoanalyst or the Jungian analyst is then to stand in those fractured places with the client and do what?
Well, you know, the more we work in this field, the better we get at doing the kinds of healing work that is necessary. We used to think that, you know, our work as psychoanalysts was more interpretive. We would understand the basic dynamic structure of the psyche and understand something about the person's individual and unique suffering and woundedness, and we would be able to then interpret a dream in terms of what it meant.
Yes.
And this was supposed
to be healing. And then there would be a great illumination and all would be
yes.
well.
Illumination and insight was the preferred thing. We now know that when you're working with early trauma, that kind of insight doesn't do very much to help the person. In some cases of more healthy neurotic psychology, where the symbolic function and symbolic thinking is intact and well founded, a more interpretive, insight-oriented therapy can be very helpful. But with early trauma, and this gets into some of the neuroscience that that I put in the book, especially the work of Alan Shore and Ian McGilchrist and some of the other neurologists that are showing now that when we're very young, say the first 18 months of life, the right hemisphere of the brain, which is the hemisphere that that encodes things like, well, it encodes, it's the hemisphere that tends to be involved in dreams, in visionary experience, in poetry, in music, in all the sort of nonverbal, iconic forms of representation. That's the hemisphere that's online in our very earliest life. So if we were traumatized in those years or those months, it's going to be coded in those forms. It's going to be in highly affective, emotional, iconic, imagistic form. It's not going to be reachable by words. So what we find in the therapy now is that, back to your question, Philip Bromberg in New York calls it standing in the spaces. When a child has to dissociate unbearable experience, it creates a gap in the psyche. And he means by standing in the spaces that we go into those gaps. And what that means is that if we're sitting with somebody and, for example, we've just been on vacation and the patient comes in and we can tell that there's no contact with the patient after this absence, and yet they're not talking about it, but we notice that the rapport that was there the previous session just has evaporated. Now we know to go into that, to that gap, and to say something like, gee, I'm feeling that we're out of contact today. Do you notice it too? And what might account for that? I wonder if you have any feelings about my being away last week. And sometimes you get very rapidly to some very deep feeling of resentment, of injury, that parallels the early ruptures in attachment that the person felt when they were very little.
Yes.
And that's now being relived in the therapy. And so when you go into those in a more feelingful and sometimes imagistic way, sometimes the patient will bring in a dream that they've been abandoned on a desert island someplace,
yeah,
or something like that, you get to the affect and the feeling much more readily than the verbal insight that we used to use.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of those kind of special moments, I believe you say that there are moments of almost divine illumination in which the analyst and client experience a sort of mystical awe and fusion. Now, I'm not expressing this with nearly the eloquence and precision you bring to the book, but maybe you could say a bit more about that.
Those are rare moments, but they do happen.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, as a Jungian analyst, I work a lot with dreams. And in a process, I have one chapter in this recent book of my work with a man named Mike, where I give a pretty thorough reprise of the whole spectrum of the analysis with a lot of dreams and showing the development and evolution of the dream content. And Mike, for example, was the kind of person who came into therapy without any expectation that he would go as deep as he did in his dream life, and his unconscious opened up dramatically. And the process of the dreaming itself, it was as though he and I were companioned by a very wise ancient shaman or something that sent these dreams that helped his process along in remarkable ways and provided a commentary from a very deep place in his psyche about the way he was experiencing the analysis and the way he was experiencing me. And you have to read Jung in order to understand what this is about. I mean, the actual companioning of the process from the unconscious of the patient is a remarkable thing. It doesn't happen very often, but there are those rare cases, and Mike was a traumatized individual where we would sit sometimes both in tears with the beauty and the incredible meaning that was brought by some of his imagery.
Yeah, I was particularly touched by that chapter and could easily understand how on his presentation at first, this did not seem like somebody who would be psychologically minded. He was a very athletic, extroverted kind of guy who didn't seem to be at all oriented toward the inner world.
That's right. He didn't. And he didn't even know he had an inner world.
I mean, yeah. I know the type. I've taught dream classes when I was busy as a professor to undergraduates, and there was a certain type of guy that he reminds me of, and so it's a remarkable account.
Very extroverted, very well adapted, very attractive, enormous energy, athletic, favored among all the ladies. And, a coach and all this stuff, all the outer world. But boy, he came down into himself in a dramatic way. And it was interesting with him that he had two small boys when he started his analysis. And one of the major reasons that he started was he started to feel very vulnerable and frightened for the safety of his boys. And he didn't know it at the time, but his boys were helping him into contact with the vulnerable parts of himself that had been completely dissociated.
Yes. Now, you've made reference to the child, and a major thing that you focus on in the book is the dream motif of the child. And that when a child appears in our dreams, it may be pointing to something deeper than our literal childhood. And,
that's right.
And you talk about the symbolic child as suspended between two worlds. So
right.
Tell us a little bit about that. What are the two worlds that child is suspended between?
Well, take the Christian myth, for example. There we have the image of a child who's suspended between two worlds. And, he's a... he's half divine and he's half human, right? He has,
yes.
He has two fathers, in effect. He has a transpersonal father and a personal father. Well, Jung got very interested in that motif, which is worldwide in mythology all over the world. The great heroes or the great avatars of religions are either twice born or they're born of two parents, one divine and one human. And Jung felt that particular child motif was emblematic of the fact that there's a part of the human personality that Jung called the soul or the self, that I call the soul in my book, that comes trailing clouds of glory, as it were, to use Wordsworth's image, that there's a unique spark of individuality that's sacred in each person, and that so we are children of our time and space parents, but we're also children of God, and that basic idea is the informing background, the informing myth, certainly of Jung's psychology, and therefore myself as a Jungian analyst. I grew up in that same tradition, and that mythic theme captures something very important about the work we all do in this field and the way we hold our patients in the process.
A number of dreams and myths relate to the loss and recovery of what you call the soul child. And perhaps you can share with us the baby in the cage dream. I don't know if you've got
that
book in front of you.
Oh, yeah, that was a remarkable dream. this was a woman who was referred to me because she was one of her friends. She had a poetic sensibility and a lovely artistic side, and one of her friends said, I think you'd be a good analyst someday, and she was vaguely depressed. Her children were growing up, and she didn't know what she wanted to do with the rest of her life, and as she came into therapy, her inner life opened up, and she started to feel trusting of the process between us, and a kind of safety in the container that we established together. And very soon, in her dream, in her process, her very first dream was that she was in the hardware store across the street from my office in this little village of Katona in New York. And where the hardware store was, there was a new pet store, and she loved animals, and so she was just entranced by all these little puppies and kittens playing in the newspapers of these various cages, and she was making her way up and down the aisles of this place. And suddenly she stopped dead in her tracks, and she realized there was a baby in one of the cages. And the baby's eyes were
closed. This is in the dream, right?
This is the dream.
Yes.
This didn't happen. This was her dream, right?
Right, okay.
And she was shocked and outraged, and she looked around for the store owner, and he was standing in the back looking vaguely menacing and frightening, and she didn't have the courage at the time to confront the store owner, but she woke up with a terrible start. And what unfolded very rapidly in our work with that dream and in the subsequent analysis was that she had had to banish and exile a part of herself as a little girl that couldn't go on living in this family because her mother constantly criticized her or failed to recognize her vitality, made her feel like dirt, and this part had to be sequestered and went into the unconscious, and we didn't have an image of it until this dream. And then she realized, oh my gosh, if I want to really uncover my full potential, I'm going to have to go back and recover this child.
Mm-hmm. I also loved your story about the stockbroker and the buried child dream.
Yes.
Is that one that you could share with us as well?
Sure. That was a remarkable story. A young man came to see me who was terribly depressed after his fiance broke up with him, and he said that was his only problem. There had never been anything else wrong in his life, except he just lived in a boring household, typically middle class, and he said, except that he couldn't remember anything of his childhood, and we were puzzled by that. So after a while, the analysis sort of ground to a halt. He couldn't remember any of his dreams. He was just depressed about the lost love. He wanted to know when he was going to get another girlfriend and what good therapy was. And so I got him. I sort of redoubled my efforts with him, and we agreed that we would start to do a kind of a detective work about what had happened in his childhood. What was missing? Why were there no pictures of him and his family? He'd had the fantasy that he was adopted. So he went back and he interviewed his aunts and uncles, and his mother was dead by now. But he discovered that when he was born, his mother had a postpartum psychotic breakdown and had to be hospitalized for a long period of time, and he was sent to live with an aunt where he almost died for failure to thrive. And then as he grew up in this family, the mother had rejoined the family by now, she was a very harsh disciplinarian and would, when he was bad, she would lock him in a closet in the hallway in the dark where he was terrified of spiders and roaches and stuff, and he would cry himself into numbness in that closet. It was known as his crying closet. And as these memories surfaced, through his detective work and our work and my gentle interviewing him, he suddenly had a dream, and it was the first major dream that he'd had, that that he was walking along a beach, and he saw a woman approaching him in a white terry cloth robe with a hood. And he met the woman, and she pointed to the sand, a lump in the sand, and told him to uncover this lump in the sand. And he dug into the lump in the sand, and he discovered the live body of a little boy who was also wearing a white terry cloth robe and hood.
Wow, how powerful.
Yeah, and slowly he uncovered this boy, and they were walking, they got him out, and then they were walking down the beach. And as they were walking down the beach, something remarkable happened. The water suddenly erupted with dolphins jumping and playing. And as he watched this, he was absolutely, he watched it from a lifeguard tower. Then they were up in a lifeguard tower, and the wind came and blew him over backwards. He was very arrested by this dream. And I tell in the book how when I had this experience with this patient, I was in training at the Jung Center in New York, and I happened to read Jung's essay on the divine child. And there's a paragraph in there. Do you mind if I quote it? It's just a few lines.
Oh, go ahead.
Jung said this about the divine child. He said, "Faust, after his death, is received as a boy into the choir of blessed youths." I don't know whether Goethe was referring with this peculiar idea to the cupids on antique gravestones. It's not unthinkable. Then Jung continues, "The figure of the cucullatus points to the hooded, that is the invisible one, the genius of the departed, who reappears in the childlike frolics of a new life, surrounded by the sea forms of dolphins and tritons." Now, I read that, and I had just processed with this man this dream of the unburying of new life, new memories, and then suddenly the eruption of the sea with dolphins, and I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
I literally couldn't believe it. I was suddenly opened up to the fact that the imagery of the psyche is universal. It's archetypal. It's collective. And so this image of new life that he and I had uncovered with the eruption of the sea with dolphins, Jung was pointing to this imagery in an essay about the ineffable divine child, the child that represents the new life in us that that sometimes gets buried or exiled and can be recovered.
Yeah, you must have felt very close to Jung at that point.
I did. If I hadn't been in Jungian training, I think I would have gone across the street and gotten into it.
Yeah, really. Now, you describe a defensive process in which sometimes angelic personifications can emerge initially as the archetypal benefactors for the patient, but as time goes on, they may turn upon the victim and become demonic and persecutory.
Yes.
This description reminds me that many first-time psychotic episodes also follow this pattern. Isn't that so?
They can. Do you have some personal experience with that, Dave?
Well, yeah. I mean, not in terms of me going psychotic, but yes.
No, I mean your clinical work.
Yeah, I do. And that's why I thought of that. And I just thought, well, that's an interesting parallel that, it happens in psychosis, and yet the people you're writing about aren't necessarily psychotic.
No, they're not. Let me give you an example that I cite in the book. Actually, I cite this example in both books. It's such an arresting story. This is a story about a little girl. This comes to us from England through a Jungian analyst named Esther Harding. But the little girl in this story was asked, she was 4 or 5 years old, and she was asked by her mother to take a note to her father who was reading in the den. And she took the note, and she reappeared in a few minutes crying and said to her mother, "Mother, the angel won't let me go in."
Yeah.
And the mother said, you know, she knew that this little girl was really very deep into the imagination, mythopoetic imagination. So she said, "Well, now you just tell the angel to, you know, that you have to deliver this note to your daddy." Well, so that she sent the girl back again. She returned another few minutes later, this time sobbing uncontrollably and saying, "Mommy, the angel won't let me go in." So the mother took her by the hand, walked her down to the threshold of the father's study, looked through the door, and saw her husband, the girl's father, dead in his chair from a massive heart attack.
Yeah, I remember now that story. That's powerful.
Yeah, that's a typical example of the appearance of these, of what you call the spiritual benefactor, the angelic figure. And, you know, it's kind of interesting how we could understand that story. From a purely Freudian, secular, materialistic standpoint, that little girl clearly made up the angel in order to feel better, in order to tolerate that experience. In other words, the angel would be a delusion or hallucination, which is the way Freud approached all of religious experience. If you looked at it from the standpoint of say, an Orthodox Christian tradition, you might say that this little girl's guardian angel on high saw the impossible situation she was in and sent its messenger to her as an act of salvation or an act of spiritual rescue or something. Now, if you took a psycho-spiritual or a psychological, depth psychological orientation, which I'm trying to do in this book, to that event, you would say, well, okay, I can clearly see the defensive quality of this presence. It did save this little girl's psyche at that time, in the sense of protected her from too much information too soon, that information that she could not metabolize or assimilate. So we could say that it's a defense, but what is it defending? And here's where I have a couple of pages on this example in my book, where I talk about what the angel accomplishes for the little girl is it gives her a mythopoetic story, a matrix, within which to help her hold this experience, which is impossible to hold without it. In other words, the angel is present now in the story. So what the angel does is restore a mythopoetic matrix for this little girl, and it appears to do that because it's in that matrix that the soul can survive, the soul can live. So that the angel protects the soul of this child from utter annihilation or destruction by providing some insulation between her and the reality of her father's death. Now, to pick up on your further comment, Dave, the fact is that this angel can't do this indefinitely, and we don't know the results of that event or the rest of that story. If the mother had been able to step in and mediate for the child and hadn't disappeared into her own crisis, that angel probably wouldn't have had to hang around for too long, and the child would have had a way within the interpersonal matrix of processing her experience. But if the mother disappeared or, you know, in traumatic environments, there's very little mediation from the parents, then that angel would have have had to stay around and become a kind of spiritual defense for this girl. And what we find is that in the trauma survivors, the benevolent forces in that self-care system, the angelic forces, rapidly turn into persecutory forces.
That seems a little paradoxical, and you do help us to understand that. You say sometimes defenses have survival value, and sometimes they keep us in hell forever. And you use Dante's epic poem, The Inferno, as a metaphoric map to describe the states of suffering that traumatized patients endure. So take us through whatever part of that calls to you right now.
Well, the reason that these archaic and archetypal is a word that means simply archaic and typical, archetypal.
Oh, I love that breakdown of it. Thank you.
Yeah, so it simply means that these are archaic remnants in the psyche. These are images that come from a very deep stratum of what Jung called the collective unconscious, which is where the angels and the demons reside. And these forces are part of all of our inheritance. They exist in us. And if we have traumatic experience, they get recruited for defensive purposes. They become part of an archetypal self-care system, which is why I got interested in them in the first place. So if these daimonic forces, angels and demons, are designed to cut the person off from a reality in the world that's just unbearable, they can do that for a time by just protecting the child, but pretty soon it's very hard to cut a child off from reality unless you start to attack the child's efforts to link to reality, and that's what happens when these forces become more persecutory. The basic idea is that the child who wants to reach out and reattach in the world is discouraged from doing so by an attack by these defensive systems. I'm talking about trauma now. And so what we find is in the adult life of such a person is that there's an internal saboteur, a fifth column, a kind of a dark critic that is always attacking their hopes, always attacking their wishes to connect, their wishes to improve, their wishes to change. And it disconnects them from their hope and from the possibility of new life in the world and from relationship.
Well, would it be fair to say that they go into the state of suffering and it's defensive in as much as it's the ongoing suffering is somehow protecting them from something that would be worse and intolerable, which would be to squarely see, for example, to squarely see that they were unloved by the mother?
That's exactly right. The reality of their situation in the world is so unbearable that their hearts would break, their souls would be murdered or annihilated. So the suffering that is provided for them is a suffering of isolation, and that's where my Dante chapter came in. I got very interested in the fact that Dante's name for the fallen angel who creates all the problems for people in hell in the medieval imagination is named Dis, D-I-S. And that's a word from which we get dissociation, which is the main defense used in trauma, and dis-ease and disconnection, disavowal, even disaster, which means literally to be separated from your stars, disaster.
Yeah, I thought that was a remarkable...
isn't that interesting?
Yeah, very interesting. Are you the first person to observe that?
No, I don't think so. I think that's been observed. Well, at least I got intrigued by it because, you know, one's stars are sort of the sparks, the scintillae of one's true selfhood, one's soul life. And so if you get disastered, your life becomes a disaster. You've lost your lodestar. You've lost your direction. Your basic meaning.
Yeah.
Anyway, that chapter on Dis and his minions. I simply got very intrigued with the fact that Hades, as it's imaged in Dante, is a great outpicturing for what I call a self-care system, the trauma survival fortress and system full of negativity and dismembering violence. And the suffering that goes on in there is endless and it's chronic. But you're right in pointing out that it's a suffering that is tolerable to the person trying to survive in this life because it's a substitute for the suffering that is necessary if the person is to truly heal and change.
I was interested in your suggestion that the affects associated with these traumatic memories is deeply encapsulated in the body, and for that reason, body therapy approaches might be particularly relevant and effective. And you draw on the work of neuroscience authors, as you mentioned, Dan Siegel and Alan Shore, to describe the process by which these implicit memories might be formed at a biochemical level.
That's right, and it fits with what I was saying earlier about the right hemisphere being online for the first month. We now know that affect, is encoded in the body, and when we have affects that are unbearably painful, they get embedded in various forms in the musculature, gesture, breathing, different facets of embodied life, and we don't have access to them until we pay attention to the body. This came home to me one time in a Milwaukee massage parlor where I was having my shoulder worked on, and the masseuse was telling me about a man she was working with who had a terrible cramp in his shoulder, and she was working on it and working on it. He was a very type A personality, very hard-driven hedge fund manager kind of guy, and she was working on this thing on his shoulder, and she discharged him that day, and he called her up that night and said that she had ruined his life, that he couldn't stop crying. And she said, "Well, look, come back in here. I want to work with you further." And he got back on the table sobbing, and she said, "Okay, now I want you to just tell me anything that comes to mind as I just gently touch you here, and any fragments, feelings, images, memories, whatever." They worked the better part of that evening, and he suddenly had an image of dirt being thrown on a board. She said, "Stay with it, stay with it." He stayed with it, and he couldn't figure it out, Finally, he remembered. He was 2 years old. His father had just been killed. He was at the graveside, and they threw the first shovel full of dirt on the coffin.
Wow.
And that memory was somehow embedded in that knot in his shoulder. Now, that's a very dramatic example of it, but that's what we find in our work with very early trauma, is that some of these memories are encoded in the body and that they're not accessible. You can do verbal therapy forever and never get to that.
Well, how do you, as a Jungian analyst, then reconcile your work with that potential work on the body, on the other hand?
Well, I mean, what we would say is that until we work with that very early material in an embodied form of work, now there are many forms of body work, Alexander technique, continuum, there's active imagination and movement, there are various forms of somatic psychotherapy. Peter Levine's work is emblematic.
Yes.
Sharon Stanley's work, Pat Ogden's work. A lot of people are now working in this area where they're paying attention to gesture and and a lot of embodied ways of being in the moment, in the therapy session. And they're finding, you know, that this opens up certain very early feelings and traumatic experiences in ways that verbal therapy just hasn't been able to get at. Now, once you get that material from very early childhood work done, then the symbolic process opens up and you can do the usual kinds of things that we're good at in Jungian dream work.
Well, I applaud your openness to these ideas and your flexibility in that regard. Let's skip ahead in the time that we have left here to in Chapter 8, in which you write about Jung and his inner crisis. And in part, you explain that you wrote this chapter in reaction to the psychoanalyst D.W. Winnicott, who you mentioned previously, who you say misunderstood and pathologized Jung.
Right. Yeah, that's been an article that Winnicott, Jung wrote a famous autobiography called Memories, Dreams, Reflections, which is one of the major books that introduces Jung to the world. It's a fabulous autobiography, and in that biography, he talks about his early life and about his parents' separation when he was very young, about his coming to mistrust the word love because his parents had separated. Then he also talks about God's world and the world of his mythopoetic imagination and all of his dramatic fantasies and his number one and his number two personalities. And Winnicott read that and came at it from his basically Kleinian background and understanding, which is that a unit personality has to develop in the early months of life. And what he means by a unit personality basically is that the child has to be able to get his love and his aggression, his hatred, together in one place. He has to be able to work through a process of loving and hating with a receptive and coherent family system and parents. Klein called that the depressive position. When you work through to that point, you then don't have to split the world between the good objects and the bad objects. You get them both together in a coherent, unified object that you can both love and dislike, or love and be angry at. Now, that's a very useful understanding of every child's early experiences with love and hate. But that was the template that Winnicott plastered onto Jung's autobiography, and he concluded that Jung had never reached unit status because he had his number one and his number two personality all the time, even through later childhood, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, all the way up through adolescence. And so Winnicott concluded that Jung was an example of childhood schizophrenia, and that he had basically healed himself, but that it was only a very partial cure, and that one that really haunted Jung, you know, the psychopathology that Jung showed haunted him the rest of his life. And I've always been upset with that article that Winnicott, his critique of Jung's autobiography, which was published shortly after the autobiography came out, because I felt that Winnicott really did not understand anything about the mythopoetic dimension of the unconscious and the way it can really provide a matrix for the soul before it can come down into this world. And Jung clearly is an example of that, because he saved himself, or he was saved, by his extraordinary imagination, his dreams, his visions, and so I wrote a whole chapter about this, criticizing Winnicott's criticism of Jung.
Go ahead.
The wider point was, you know, the book is about trauma and the soul, and I feel that Jung's soul was saved without a psychosis, and that Winnicott really didn't get the religious dimension of the psyche, which is something that's essential to understand Jung.
Well, I take it that Winnicott wrote his article well before the Red Book was released.
Yes, he did, well before that.
And I wonder what he would have made of the Red Book.
You know, I don't know. I really don't know. That would be a very interesting question.
Yeah, because
ponder that.
Because I could see, I could see him. You know, I could see him perhaps trying to use that as evidence for pathology.
Yeah, he might have gone that direction.
Yeah.
That's conceivable, or he might have been, you know, impressed at how faithful Jung was to a dialogical process with inner figures,
mm-hmm.
And how he worked out. I suspect Winnicott would have thought of that as part of Jung's self-cure,
mm-hmm.
that Jung didn't have an analyst and found a way, nonetheless, to have a dialogue with these inner figures and work out his feelings.
Yeah. I love the story of the little mannequin that Jung carved out at 10 years old. He carved off a piece of a ruler and created this little mannequin and hid it in the attic. And,
that's right.
And then wrote little secret messages in a unknown language. Was that in Dreams, Memories,
that's
Reflections?
That's in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. That's one of the really precious memories that Jung talks about. And to me, that's a beautiful example of the way Jung needed to provide a little image of his own soul life, you know, the sacred center of him, and actually carve it as a little mannequin and put it in his pencil box and put it on a beam up in the attic and make little a little library for it out of sayings that he felt were really wise. And that gave Jung a tremendous feeling of peace and security in the sort of traumatic life he was living in the school he was in at the time. And it's a wonderful example of how the soul really needs to be sequestered sometimes in order to be saved.
He was a Jungian already.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
You know, Jung used to say, when people would want to go into training, he didn't want to do a training institute in his own name. He used to say, "Thank God I'm not a Jungian. I'm only Jung."
Right. Well, as we wind down now, is there anything more that you'd like our listeners to know?
Gee, David, I don't think so. I feel like we've covered a pretty broad swath of this book in a short time, and I appreciate your questions because they've helped me download some of my own ideas in a really, I hope, accessible way. I hope your listeners will enjoy this.
Well, I am sure that they will. So, Dr. Donald Kalshed, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're very welcome. It's been my pleasure. All the best.
Hi, Eric. It's good to have you here again.
No, great to be here.
Now, I know you were particularly interested in this upcoming interview with Dr. Kalshed because you'd had some exposure through the Depth Psychology program you're in, right?
That's right. I've been really excited for this interview today. And his work with trauma and grief and things really, really hit home for me and has been, has had an impact on my life. And of course, we've studied him in the classroom as well at Sonoma State. So this was a really enjoyable experience.
Yeah, well, it was fortuitous. I didn't know that when I set out to interview him, but it was fortuitous that this should dovetail with your needs.
Right.
And with your experience. What did you think of how the interview went?
I thought it was great, and the first thing that jumped out to me was in talking about his binocular vision in storytelling, which is just a great metaphor for keeping an awareness of the outside world as well as the inner reality in telling a story and in telling one's truth.
Yeah, and telling one's own story and exploring one's own inner world. Huh?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a sort of a paradox that there are two versions of reality that are going on all the time. That external version and the internal version, of which we have some awareness and much of which that we don't have much awareness. I was happily surprised by how friendly and accessible he was. His book is, I think it's, you know, it's an intellectual, a very solid, intellectual, elegantly written, very carefully researched Jungian book. And so it was nice to experience the person on the other end, and as somebody who is really very open and flexible and could laugh and be loose.
I always find it great to be able to put a voice to the the reading itself. And you know, at first glance, or my first thought in reading about trauma and grief was, oh man, this is going to be really heavy and depressing and whatnot. But my experience with Dr. Kalshed's work couldn't be more opposite. You know, what I found was a very rich and very powerful experience in his work that was actually quite enjoyable to read.
And I'm glad that we could cover as much of the book as we did in the interview. I think we covered certainly the highlight, the overall feel of it came through in this interview. For anyone who is deeply interested in Jungian thought, I would strongly recommend this book. It's definitely readable, but it requires some dedication and some, I think, some passion for the Jungian perspective to kind of motor your way through it. And so if you're that kind of person, then I think you'd like this book. What do you think?
I think so, absolutely. And really, you can pick it up and read a chapter at a time.
Yeah.
And there's so much material in it. And what I love about his writing is the wonderfully vivid imagery that comes to mind. It's it really just provides a very unique experience.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be thrown by the title Trauma and the Soul, because yes, it deals with trauma and grief and these themes, but it really is much more than that. In my experience.
Well, one of the things that impressed me is the breadth of material that he draws from. And as you heard, he's drawing from some of the latest thinking in neuroscience. He's drawing from classic psychoanalytic as distinct from Jungian analysts. He goes to the Freudian analysts and draws very freely from some of the major figures in that tradition. He goes to mythology and fairy tales. You know, he has a whole chapter on Dante's Inferno. Just the way that he weaves all of this stuff together from such different sources. I didn't ask him, but I suspect that this book was years in the making.
I would imagine it would be, and especially with the accounts of you know, his working with patients, and you know, he pulls from dreams and from myths and from fairy tales and really weaves this unique pattern.
You know, it's my habit to turn the recorder off as soon as I've thanked the person for their participation, and usually they say thank you back. And sometimes I regret that, because afterwards sometimes they will say some really wonderful stuff that I wish had gotten recorded. And in this instance, he shared that he has never listened to Shrink Wrap Radio, but that he had heard about it from some Jungian colleagues, and he named Monica Wickman, who longtime listeners will know I have interviewed a number of times. And as I described what the show is and that I had interviewed many of the people that he mentioned both in this interview and in his book, he really lit up, and he said, wow, how can I support this show? What does it cost to join?
Right.
And he was shocked when I said, it's all free. You know, I've struggled with whether or not to figure out a way to charge or not, but it's all free, but we do get donations. And he said he would become a donor, and he would help spread the word. And so, needless to say, I was excited by all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, it is such a valuable resource, myself as a student, and I'm sure as professionals. And he did seem somewhat shocked to learn that this is a free service for people.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes I feel a little burdened by the weekly schedule. You know, oh, here's another one. I'm going to do another one. But what, you know, there are a couple things that really keep me going. One is the feedback that I get from listeners, which is uniformly supportive, enthusiastic, etc. And the other is just the joy of making contact with somebody like this and feeling like, hey, there is a connection here. We're understanding each other. I do get his material. He gets that I get his material. And that's a wonderful, wonderfully reinforcing feeling. Okay, so I guess that's going to wrap it up for you and me. And I'll look forward to your support the next time that we do one of these.
Don't let the podcast well run dry. Keep these outstanding podcasts coming and support Dr. Dave by going to the website and clicking on the big green donate button. If we can all remember to make a donation, it will mean the difference between always having new and captivating interviews to listen to or not. Donate as much as you like, and in that way, Dr. Dave will be able to continue on his journey to educate, entertain, nurture, and inspire.
Thank you, Sister Sherry West. And actually, it's no longer the big green donate button. It's now the multicolored support button in the right-hand sidebar. So take a tip from my sister Sherry and join our family by showing your support today. I'm happy to announce that we do have a new transcript on the site. It's number 402, Techniques for Relieving Depression Without Medication, with Bill O'Hanlon, and that's thanks to Shrink Wrap Radio intern Eric Hanley. As you know from recent shows, I'm currently doing some advertising here for Audible.com, which I feel very good about, inasmuch as I've long been one of their customers. Like you, I love getting good audio content. I've got an Audible recommendation for you. If you're a longtime listener, you might recall Shrink Wrap Radio number 252, A Buddhist Perspective on Psychotherapy with Mark Epstein, MD. He's not only a Buddhist, but also a psychoanalyst, and since we've been discussing psychoanalysis along with Jungian analysis today, I thought you'd enjoy Dr. Mark Epstein's unabridged book, Thoughts Without a Thinker, Psychotherapy from a Buddhist Perspective, and it's read aloud by the author himself. You can get this audio book for free, with no obligation to continue, by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. If you're new to Shrink Wrap Radio, you might not be aware that we have an app for that. That is, for listening to these shows and communicating with me. And you can find full details on our site under the Apps tab.
Dr. Dave, we thank you for your humanistic, transpersonal, and existential approach to psychology. Congratulations on your awesome podcast.
Hello, Dr. Dave. It's Michael Nistler here. As my robotic friend said, kudos to you, and please keep those podcasts coming. We're all crazy about you.
Thank you, Michael. Now let me share a couple of recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. First, we hear from Daniel in the UK, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm Daniel, the partner of Rosie, the funeral director slash psychotherapist." And as an aside here, hopefully you remember my reading her email in the last episode. So back to Daniel's. He says, "I'm glad to hear she made you laugh. She brings much joy to my life too. But don't imagine I'm a great mimic or anything. I just play with the English idea of the laid-back West Coast accent. It's a silly cliche, but not done with any malice or great skill." Another aside here, Rosie had reported that Daniel had been doing an imitation of me. And so I said that I hoped he would send me an audio file, that I'd love to hear it. It doesn't sound like that's going to be forthcoming. He goes on to say, "I love your show, too, and we have had many discussions based on your interviews. My training in integrative psychotherapy has been enriched by your dedication and wide interests, and we both share your enthusiasm for asking around rather than sticking rigidly to one doctrine. And, of course, I'm affected by your responses, too. I enjoy your openness and transparency and your willingness to let yourself be known. Some episodes have touched me very personally. I would also like to say something about listening whilst driving. As Rose mentioned, I do a lot of driving and thinking in the car. I get drowsy when I read books, and I listen very differently at home. I get easily distracted. In the car, I feel more to be affected emotionally rather than to take notes or engage in a critical mind. Driving through the Yorkshire hills with a beautiful landscape and all, its embedded memories flowing by, I become less technical, less of a student, and I hear how you and your interviewees are affected by sharing their work. I feel inspired and nourished by such dedication and commitment. As I work with sound and the body, I'm sensitive to voice inflections and expressive shifts in tone. In this driving mode especially, I'm more receptive to my transference and subconscious involvement with the interview. For example, your Wise Counsel interview with Dan Rima on trauma and art made me weep and weep. When I gave it some thought later, I realized I was missing my own creative engagement and how much I feared the loss of that part of me. As I approach my professional practice and my previous life as an artist recedes, I'm aware how important my creativity will be in making me an authentic and responsive therapist. Dan Rima described having to make art not as a rational choice, but as something that he needed to accept for his own health. I felt this need in his voice like an existential call. After one show, you told of some attempts to modernize the show with the help from a production company. I'm glad you resisted their format changes, and I like the way the show has developed. I'm glad I resisted them, too. He goes on to say, I really appreciate the amount of work you put in, but I wonder if there is value in the idea of calling out for others to record content or snippets, perhaps comments and reflections on previous interviews or potted biographies of inspirational people, book reviews or suggestions, conference reviews, descriptive readings of approaches to work. I love the interviews, but sometimes I really want to hear a step-by-step description of how a piece of work was done. These are just suggestions. The show stands up well as it is. I'm looking forward to more shows and will let you know when I've made a contribution. Best wishes, and that's from Daniel Weaver in Todmorden, England. Well, thanks so much for that, Daniel. And I'm disappointed that I don't think I'm going to get a recording of your imitation of Dr. Dave. And in the email reply that I gave, I think I didn't quite realize that you were suggesting that I ask others to send in recorded snippets. Because in my reply, I sort of had the feeling like, hey, you're making more work for me, not less. But I have to tell you, even with inviting snippets from other people, I don't get that many recorded things from people that I ask for. You know, people who make donations and I ask for an audio, and not everybody submits one. And I give my phone number out every time and nobody calls. So, while my listeners are very generous in terms of the feedback that they give me, it's not always easy to get them to submit things like that. Plus, it would add to the length of the overall show, and I don't want to do that either. So I really thought that your report of the way you were affected by the interview on art was very touching, and I appreciate your sharing that. So, I'm sure that with the sensitivity that you have, that you'll be a very good therapist indeed, or already are one. So, thanks for writing, and feel free to reach out and contact me again in the future. Now, here's another one, and this one is from Tony in Portland, who writes, Dr. Dave, I love your podcast, and you find great people to interview. I have a suggestion. Whom I really think you would benefit others. Dr. David Rico, another Dr. Dave, is a psychologist from San Francisco and Santa Barbara whose work has really made a huge difference in my life. I read his book, How to Be an Adult, at just the right time. He also has many other books, including Being an Adult in Relationships, Shadow Work, Ego Work, etc. It really helped me to see that I had some hurts, some misunderstandings, and some misguided mentors, but that everything is okay when I realize that I am okay and I let myself feel. He also has a number of fabulous lecture series available for purchase, some of which I purchased and still listen to. Growing Pains and Going On, Childhood Early Experience, Ego Healthy and Neurotic, Ego Issues of Fear, Attachment, Control, and Entitlement, Befriending the Shadow, Shadow Work. I guess those are the recordings. He goes on to say, I'm not affiliated with Dr. Rico. I just think others would benefit from hearing him. He has appeared on other podcasts just once or twice that I can find, so he is truly a hidden resource. And then Tony goes on to give me contact information, the website for Dr. Rico, which is www.daverico.com. And so I actually followed up on this suggestion and have already lined up an interview with Dr. Rico. And so that will be coming up in the next 2 or 3 weeks. So, Tony, thank you so much for that suggestion. You see, I do act on these listener suggestions, and there was something about that one that really hit home for me. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our new message phone at 415-830-4014. Prove me wrong and leave a voice message. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, which, as I mentioned earlier, you can find full details about it in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks again to Dr. Donald Kalshed for sharing his penetrating analysis of developmental trauma and the soul. My next guest will be dream worker Tokopa Turner, who will be a presenter at the upcoming Synchronicity Symposium in Joshua Tree, California, on September 12, 13, and 14. So, until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long, just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet, and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, babe, it's all in your mind. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.